Hey guys, just a quick message before we get started. As you know, Fable Beard Company is the official beard company of the American History Podcast. And as this episode airs, it is the holiday season. So if you're looking for some amazing beard oil for that special someone in your life, or any sort of beard product for that matter, head over to the Fable Beard Company and check out their entire line of beard balm, butter, and oil. Maybe you need something for the lady in your life. They have you covered there as well. Fable Beard Company has an amazing line of hair oils and body butters that your girlfriend, your wife, or female friend will totally love and enjoy using. When it comes to beard products, I myself am particularly fond of the beard oils that are infused with CBD. Specifically, I love the roaster, but I'm also fond of the grower as well. Whatever scent is the one you pick, I assure you it'll be the best beard purchase you've ever made, and these products are the perfect gift for that beard man in your life. So head over to Fable Beard Company at www.fablebeardco.com for the regular products and fablebeardcompany.com for their line of CBD infused items. Use coupon code SEAN15 to get 15% off the total order. And by the way, you can use that code again and again. It isn't simply for the first order. All right, now on with the show. The American History Podcast, Season 3, Episode 20, The United States in World War I, Part 1.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
Welcome back. As always, let me invite you to follow me on social media. We are on every platform out there, so there are plenty of ways that you can interact with me. First, there's Twitter. The handle is at American Hiscast. We also have a Facebook page, so just search for the American History Podcast, and we are now on Instagram. So you can just search for the American History Podcast and follow us. I'm posting photos over there, and I hope you enjoy them. Now, if you want to send me some hate mail, just send that to shawn@theamericanhistorypodcast.com. I do answer all emails that come my way, so don't worry. I'm not going to ignore you. No matter what, I will answer, and I will always try and respond politely. Finally, if you'd like to support the show, there are a couple ways you can do so. First, you can join the Patreon, where you get goodies in return. For a total of $3 a month, you can have access to the bonus show, 1983, the year the world almost ended. You also get the episode both free and commercials and a week ahead of everybody else. To sign up, just go to the website, www.theamericanhistorypodcast.com, and click on the Patreon button on the right side, and then boom, you will be on Patreon. Now, if you don't want to sign up for Patreon, you can support us when you shop on Amazon. And let's face it, we all use Amazon. Again, just go to the website, our website, I should say, click on one of the linked sources, and boom, you're on Amazon. You don't have to purchase the item itself, but as long as you enter through Amazon, through that link, they will give us a few pennies and cost you none. So you win and we win. And let's face it, the holiday season is upon us and we will all be shopping on Amazon. All right, enough of that. Now, this episode promises to be a long one, so let's get into it. This week, the song of the week is Over There by Nora Bays. See y'all on the other side.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling you and me. Everyone for liberty. Hurry right away, no delay, start today. Make your daddy glad to have had such a lad. Tell your sweetheart not to pine, to be proud of our boys in line. Over there, over there. Send the word over there. That the Yanks are coming. Drums coming everywhere. So prepare, say a prayer. Send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there.
Okay, so before we jump into the episode fully, let me offer a bit of introduction. I try not to do this as often as I think I'm wordy enough, but I think it's appropriate here. The importance of World War I is often brushed over by American historians, seeing as how this it is, for the United States, a short war. It was also, by the end, not popular, and led to a return to the former policy of minding our own business. However, I think historian William Appleman Williams said it best in his book, The Contours of American History, when he says that World War I was the culmination of the period of transformation which the United States had been going through. This was the point at which the progressive movement, according to Williams, adapted to the corporation. In other words, it was taken over by the corporation. And furthermore, because it's the end of one era, so to speak, it's also the start of a new one. He postulates that rather than see World War I as the interwar period and then World War II as three different eras, it's more accurate to see them as the same era. And I think that's a good way of analyzing the time period. When I taught AP European history especially, I tended to refer to World War I and World War II as the 20th century version of the 30 Years' War. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is the importance of President Wilson. It seems that when politicians are asked who their favorite president is, they often named Theodore Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln. The current occupant of the White House, and it's right now it's the fall of 2020 as I record this, might have said Andrew Jackson, but I'm not sure he knows enough history for us to put much meaning into that answer. But be that as it may, the reality is we live in a Wilsonian world to a great extent. The foundation of U.S. foreign policy is built on a Wilsonian base. So I'd have to say that it's impossible to overemphasize the importance of Wilson in World War I, either from an American history perspective or even from a world history perspective. The reality is, as British historian Hugh Strachan notes, we live in a world created by World War I. All right, so just a bit of background. On June 28, 1914, Serbian nationalist Gavrilo Princip assassinated the Austrian heir, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and his wife in Sarajevo, Bosnia-Herzegovina, a province of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Now, a result of this was that in July, Austria issued a list of demands to Serbia, designed to be rejected. Why? Well, the Austrians were spoiling for a fight. Amazingly, Serbia agreed to all of them except one. Now, Serbia was backed by Russia, and the Russians began mobilizing for war. This, in my opinion, is what caused the conflagration. Now, if you've read any recent history on, by recent, I mean anything published after, say, 1960, you probably have read or heard that it was all Germany's fault. Critic of the war, Henry Barnes, thought Germany was the least culpable. Germany was, at the time, looking for a way to avoid what was more and more looking to be unavoidable. Now, I know you're going to come at me with the blank check thing. They didn't really give a blank check to Austria. It's more complicated than that. I mean, sure, they said they'd back them, but the Kaiser was looking for a way out of all this. And the Germans were trying to put a brake on this whole thing, believe it or not. However, Russia began to mobilize. They did this because they tended to be slow and they were less industrialized. So they felt it was a necessary measure, you know, just in case. However, that meant Germany had to either get in there now or sit it out. They decided to, as the saying goes, roll the iron dice, and they jumped in. Let's face it, they'd have been embarrassed had they allowed their ally Austria to be defeated by the Russians, assuming, of course, that Russia won. Now, I admit that I'm a bit different on this than most historians, but the so-called Fischer thesis, which blames Germany, isn't all that popular these days. Harvard historian Neil Ferguson, in his book The Pity of War, lays the blame squarely at the doorstep of the British. And I admit, it's a convincing argument, so please check it out. I'll also say there are some things that I disagree with, so it's probably my least favorite of these books that I'm about to recommend. I'd also recommend Hunt Tooley's book, The Western Front, Battleground, and Homefront in the First World War. A third book that you might like is A World Undone, The Story of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, by G.J. Meyer, which is really great. It's a great read. Finally, I recommend The First World War by Hugh Strachan. Indeed, I personally think the latter three books you're going to find particularly insightful, especially Strachan's book. Okay, so Germany declared war on Russia and France, and on August 1st, they launched a massive invasion of France through Belgium. Now, the objective was to knock France out of the war as soon as possible, thus freeing Germany up to concentrate all of her power on Russia. The British, seeing her coastline and possibly her empire jeopardized by the invasion of Belgium, allied with France and declared war on Germany on August 4, 1914. Now, I should mention the British were divided on the idea of going to war, but in the end, they joined the fray. British Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey remarked to a friend on the eve of war being declared, quote, "The lamps are going out all over Europe, and we shall not see them lit again in our lifetime," end quote. A year later, the Allied powers, Britain, France, and Russia, lured Italy to join their side. 4 long years of bloody trench warfare dominated the Western Front, while horrific mobile fighting occurred in the Eastern Europe. By the end of the war, nearly 10 million soldiers were dead, and 20 million civilians, mostly in Russia, had perished. Finally, I already mentioned the Allied powers, France, Britain, and Russia. They were later joined by Japan, Italy, and the United States. Now, initially, they were called the Triple Entente. They were opposed by what came to be called the Central Powers, Germany, Austro-Hungary, and later the Ottoman Empire. This was also called the Triple Alliance, just to confuse us. As you know, the United States, for the first 3 years of the war, remained officially neutral. Now, I'd argue that they were allied with the Allies and helped them in many ways, except with troops. But both the Allies and the Central Powers attempted to gain American support. The British, of course, enjoyed close cultural, linguistic, and economic ties with the United States, although they'd not been the best of friends ever since the days of the American Revolution. The British used propaganda in the United States to demonize the Germans. Now, on the other hand, Germany and Austro-Hungary counted on the natural sympathies of German Americans, and they made up a significant portion of the population. In 1914, 11 million Americans had at least one foreign-born parent with blood ties to Central Powers. Some openly supported Germany, but most were simply grateful to be away from Europe and the war. You also had Irish Americans and Jewish Americans who, in general, did not favor the Allies. Now, from the outset, many Americans were anti-German. First, they saw Kaiser Wilhelm II as a symbol of the arrogant autocracy and Germany as ruthless for its invasion of neutral Belgium. I'd say British propaganda had done its job, wouldn't you? To make matters worse, German and Austrian agents hurt the image of the Central Powers when they resorted to violence in American factories and ports. However, the vast majority of Americans were simply eager to just stay out of the war. Initially, the outbreak of war in Europe had a devastating impact on the American economy. Germany, France, Britain, and Austria went off the gold standard in an effort to finance the war through inflation. They sought to exchange their American securities for U.S. gold. This led to a drain of gold from the country and threatened to sink the American stock market and the banking system worldwide. However, it should be noted that the American economy was already on shaky ground at this point anyways. As Marianne Rothbard points out in his excellent book, Wall Street, Banks, and American Foreign Policy, the United States had been in a recession since 1913. Unemployment was high and many factories were operating at 60% of capacity. In November 1914, Andrew Carnegie allied with Morgan interests, and you should know Wilson was supported by J.P. Morgan and his allies, wrote to Wilson lamenting the current state of the economy, but expected things to turn around thanks to Allied purchases of American exports. Sure enough, by early 1915, Treasury Secretary McAdoo wrote to Wilson hailing the great prosperity the Allied purchases were bringing to American industry, and later that year, a business writer noted that war for Europe is meaning devastation and death. For America, it's a bumper crop of new millionaires and a hectic hastening of prosperity. Now, eventually, trade with the Allied nations reached $2.4 billion. J.P. Morgan and other bankers lent the Allies over $3 billion during the time the U.S. was quote-unquote neutral. Of course, there was one problem. It was imperative, and I can't emphasize this enough, it was imperative that the British and their allies win the war. Thus, Morgan and his associates did everything they could to push the United States into the war on the side of the British. Here's a quote from Morgan. Quote, "We agree that we should do all that was lawfully in our power to help the Allies win the war as soon as possible," end quote. Now, this support for one side of the war was met by protestations from Germany and Austria. The American response was that such trade did not violate international neutrality laws. Further, Germany was technically able to trade with the United States. However, the power of the Royal Navy and their blockade across the North Sea meant that it was, in reality, not going to happen. However, remember, as we've noted in recent episodes, the German and American governments were not the best of friends, so I doubt the United States would have tried hard to trade with the Germans, even if the president had been Taft or Roosevelt. In the end, trade that was lost with the Central Powers totaled only about $169 million. Moreover, Britain began forcing American vessels into British ports, which, despite the protestations of the U.S. government, proved effective in virtually ending U.S.-German trade. In response to this, the Germans announced a submarine war area around the British Isles. The submarine was a new war technology that didn't fit existing international laws. The old rule of a warship stopping and boarding a merchant ship no longer applied, as a surfacing sub could be rammed or sunk. Instead, a submarine attacked ships and sank them. In addition, Germany stated that they would not try to sink neutral shipping, but warned that mistakes would probably occur. Wilson warned Germany that it would be held to, quote, strict accountability, end quote, for any attacks on American ships or citizens. He sought to maintain profitable neutral trading rights while at the same time hoping that no shipping incident would force his hand. Now, the result of this was submarine warfare. In the first months of 1915, German U-boats sank about 90 ships in the war zone. The Lusitania, a British passenger liner, was famously sunk off the coast of Ireland on May 7, 1915. 1,198 souls died, including 128 Americans. It was carrying 4,200 cases of small arms ammunition, a fact that the German government used for sinking the ship. Germany refused to apologize, and in the United States, public opinion turned against Germany. Consequently, Wilson, who at least publicly didn't want war, sternly warned Germany against further aggressive actions against American interests. Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan, a pacifist, resigned rather than get involved in diplomacy that might lead to war. So let's look into this a bit further. Now, again, here I'm indebted to the work of Ralph Raico and his book Great Wars and Great Leaders. The Secretary of State noted that Germany had a right to prevent contraband from going to the Allies. Further, he said that a ship carrying contraband, as the Lusitania was surely doing, should not rely upon innocent civilians to protect her from an attack. Quote, it would be like putting women and children in front of an army, end quote. Finally, Bryan reminded Wilson that the American proposal, one which was rejected by Britain but accepted by Germany, called for the Germans to give up submarine warfare in exchange for allowing food into Germany. Jennings noted, why be shocked when the drowning of a few people if there is to be no objection to starving nation? He had a point. Now again, I think another point here is that Bryan knew that behind the scenes, machinations were taking place and surely realized the United States would eventually enter the war on the side of the Allies. However, he was angry that Wilson failed to order Americans to stay off belligerent ships. For his part, Wilson said, quote, there's such a thing as a man being too proud to fight, end quote. Finally, as you can imagine, warmongers such as Theodore Roosevelt cried out for German blood and savagely criticized Wilson. I'll let you decide who was right in this situation. However, this wasn't the end of the controversy. Another British ocean liner, the SS Arabic, was sunk in August with two Americans killed. It was at this point that Germany agreed to not sink unarmed and unresisting passenger ships without warning. This seemed to signal some benefit to the Wilson approach. Now, before we go any further, I just want to speak briefly about the Royal Navy, the German Navy, and American double standards. The United States had no problem with the British closing the North Sea, which of course affected more than just Germany, and I should note, is illegal. If you're going to engage in a blockade of enemy ports, you do so close in, at say 3 miles. You don't shut down the entire sea. Further, the British mined the North Sea, endangering neutral shipping as well. But never mind that. When Germany then declared the waters around Great Britain to be a war zone, the Americans howled in protest. And by that, I mean the U.S. government. So let's discuss how all of this was financed. Just a moment ago, I mentioned that the United States made massive loans to the Allies. Furthermore, the United States eventually entered the war. All of this would have to be paid for in some way, and had the same hard money gold standard system that existed prior to 1914 been in place, then there is no way that any of this could have happened. However, some might say fortuitously, in 1913, there was an institution established that made it possible, the Federal Reserve. By creating this, quote, lender of last resort, end quote, the Fed enabled the banking system to inflate money and credit, finance loans to the Allies, and float massive deficits once the United States entered the war. Are you a fan of the show and you're looking to take your learning to the next level? Well, Next Level American History Podcast is Liberty Classroom, This is a fantastic site for parents who have kids and want to enhance their learning, or for adults who are lifelong learners like myself. Go to theamericanhistorypodcast.com. On the right side, you will see a linked photo or an ad for Liberty Classroom. Click on that bad boy, and you're ready to join. You'll find courses on American history, but also on Latin American history, economics, logic, and many other subjects. All of them are taught by fantastic teachers and professors whom I trust. People like Tom Woods, graduate of Harvard and Columbia Universities, Bradley Berzer, Robert Murphy, Brian McClanahan, Jeffrey Herbener, and many other fantastic scholars. Seriously, this is an amazing site. If you're looking for a way to learn the things they didn't teach you in high school, unless you had me as a teacher, of course, then this is the place for you. Finally, if you click on that link, the American History Podcast gets a kickback. So it's a great way to support the show, and it costs you, the listener, absolutely nothing. So get on over to the website, click on Tom Wood's mug, and in no time, you'll be on your way to an amazing education. Now, the Federal Reserve was the end result of 5 years of planning and lobbying by various politicians and financial interests, led, of course, by the Morgans, the Rockefellers, and the Kuhn, Loebs, and all of their associated economists and technocrats and academics ready to make the case for the creation of a central bank. Now, again, as Rothbard notes, the creation of the Federal Reserve might have been thanks to a coalition of Morgan, Rockefeller, and Kuhn, Loeb interests, but you can rest assured the system they created was controlled by the Rockefellers and the Morgans, but especially the Morgans. Don't believe me? Well, the first Federal Reserve Board, appointed by Wilson in 1914, included Paul Moritz Warburg, a German banker who had immigrated to the United States in 1902 and spent most of his time agitating for a central bank in the United States. Now, Warburg was excluded from a senior leadership position on the board thanks to his pro-German sentiments, but he was joined by one Rockefeller man, Frederick A. Delano, you know, his nephew, Franklin D. Roosevelt. There was also an Alabama banker who was connected to both the Rockefellers and the Morgans. However, the real power lay in the hands of J.P. Morgan and his allies. Three men on the bank were his allies: Secretary of State McAdoo, Comptroller of the Currency John Skelton Williams, and Assistant Treasury Secretary Charles Hamlin. However, the most important appointee was the first governor of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, and the man who, again, according to Rothbard, single-handedly dominated Fed policy from the time of its inception until his death in 1928, and that is Benjamin Strong. Strong was unabashedly pro-war, and he worked quickly to formalize collaboration between the Fed and the Bank of England, a collaboration that would continue well into the 1920s. So what was the fruit of this collaboration? Strong was pressured to inflate money and credit in the United States in order to keep England from losing gold to the United States, thanks to its own inflationary policies. The problem was that after the war was over, Britain insisted on going back to the gold standard, but at the overvalued pre-war for the pound. In other words, they wanted to act as if the war and all of the inflation that took place had never happened. It wanted to continue to inflate rather than deflate so it could keep its exports competitively priced in the world market. Now, I wonder where they got this idea from. John Maynard Keynes, perhaps? In any event, the English needed to induce other countries, particularly the United States, into inflating their currency as well. Thus, this connection of strong Norman Morgan sowed the seeds for the crash of 1929 and the suffering that would come afterwards. In March 1916, Germany torpedoed a French passenger steamer, the Sussex. The ship was damaged, but not sunk. The 80 casualties included 4 Americans. Now, Wilson told Germany that unless she stopped sinking merchant ships without warning, he would break diplomatic relations, a prelude to war. Germany's response was to reluctantly agree not to sink passenger merchant ships unless they were given warning. However, the United States would have to persuade the Allies to modify what Germany viewed as an illegal blockade, which it kind of was. Thus, while Wilson could claim victory, it was precarious, as Germany could renounce its agreement at any time if the blockade continued to inflict damage on her. This later became known as the Sussex Pledge. All of this meant the writing was on the wall. War was imminent. Taxes were increased in preparation for the coming conflict. The Revenue Acts of 1916 and 1917 increased taxes on high incomes. The significance is that while pre-war, 75% of revenue came from excise taxes and tariffs, during and after the conflict, 75% came from income, estate, and excess profit taxes, whatever the heck excess profit actually means. now we need to discuss the election of 1916. The Republicans nominated Charles Evans Hughes. He was a former progressive governor of New York and, at the time of his nomination, a Supreme Court justice. The Bull Moose progressives renominated Theodore Roosevelt, but he had no desire to again split the Republican vote. Why? Well, the story goes that he hated Wilson. It was his refusal to run against again that effectively put an end to the Progressive Party. The progressive wing of the GOP thus supported Hughes. However, the reality was that the party was still run by the so-called Old Guard. The platform approved at the convention condemned a lower tariff, the progressive assault on trusts, and Wilson's vacillation in dealing with Mexico and Germany. More on that in a second. On the other side, the Democrat Party renominated President Woodrow Wilson. He ran on the slogan, quote, "He kept us out of war." Wow, I'm sorry, I can't help but laugh. I should say Wilson never used this phrase himself. Of course not. Some historians argue that he purposely left it out because he realized that American, and I hate this term, isolation would not last. I would argue that it's because he knew that the United States would be in a war once his second term was assured. Ironically, Democratic orators warned that electing Hughes meant getting the U.S. involved in World War I. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It's sad. I mean, looking back 100 years, you know, afterwards, it's ironically funny, but wow. The result was Wilson defeated Hughes 277 to 254 in the electoral vote. Midwesterners and Westerners voted overwhelmingly for Wilson based on his progressive reforms and his anti-war policies. Wilson also gained strong labor support from the working class and ex-Bull Moosers, who Republicans failed to get back after TR refused to run. In January, Wilson delivered a speech arguing that only a negotiated peace, one without victory, would prove durable.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you somebody that's been dealing with betrayal trauma? Are you somebody that has a really giant heart and you want to give back to this world, but you're not sure how you can do that because your trust has been broken? Well, I've got good news for you. I have the perfect podcast for you to come and listen to. It's called The Other Side of the Struggle, Healing from Betrayal Trauma by Erin Anderson Betrayal Trauma Coaching. Come learn how to trust again. Come learn how to open up that giant heart and heal from your betrayal trauma at The Other Side of the Struggle on all major platforms.
In January 1917, Germany announced a policy of unrestricted submarine warfare. Now all ships would be sunk, including American ships. Germany used the failure of the Sussex Pledge to justify this policy. The United States had failed the Allies to end, failed to get the Allies to end the illegal blockade, thus the unrestricted warfare. Germany believed the United States would enter the war, but that the Americans would be too late. Remember, at this point, Russia was devolving into revolution. The Imperial Army was in retreat and disarray. Thus, the Germans believed that they would be able to move those men devoted to the east over to the west and defeat the Allies there before the Americans could arrive. The result was that Wilson broke off diplomatic relations with Germany, but refused to move unless Germany attacked American lives and property. However, he did ask Congress to for the authority to arm U.S. merchant ships. However, Midwestern senators blocked this measure. This was the perfect example of the non-interventionist sentiment that ran deep in the country. Thus, Wilson played his ace in the hole, the Zimmerman note. What was the Zimmerman note, you ask? Well, it was a German telegram to Mexico that had been intercepted by Britain and published in the United States on March 1, 1917. It contained a secret proposal for a German alliance with Mexico. If Germany won the war, Mexico would be given Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. The second part proposed bringing Japan into an anti-American alliance. Americans, especially Westerners, as you can probably imagine, were outraged. To make matters worse, German U-boats sank four unarmed U.S. merchant ships in March 1917. What's that phrase? Let slip the dogs of war. Thus, on April 2, 1917, Wilson asked Congress for a declaration of war. On April 6, the United States declared war on Germany. Now, there are five reasons given in the standard narrative for this. First, and most importantly, was the unrestricted submarine warfare. The United States was unable to protect its ships and, at the same time, wanted to preserve trade to Allied markets. Second reason was the Zimmermann Note. The third was the Russian Revolution took place in February and March of 1917, created a democracy in Russia, and allying with that government would be more acceptable to American sensibilities than with the Tsarist regime. Now, I'm not sure that I buy that one, but okay. The fourth reason was the idea that the American entry into the war would end the war quickly and ensure that the United States would have a major role in the ensuing peace. The fifth is a moral reason, the German mass killing of civilians. Now, if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know my cynical brain doesn't accept this. But that is the normal narrative. Now, as I noted above, Rothbard argued that it was the influence of J.P. Morgan and other Anglophiles, especially, that infuriated Wilson and his decision to take the United States into the European conflagration. I'll give you the idea of another historian, this time of the great William Appleman Williams. In his book titled The Contours of American History, Williams argues the war was organized as a method to extend America's overseas economic empire. Rather than the British or the French, Wilson believed that the main competitor overseas, at least economically, was Germany. Thus, he was right in line with both Roosevelt and Taft for all of the hemming and hawing that TR hated Wilson. And one last bit here before we move forward. And I know I'm backtracking a little bit, but think about the previous episodes on imperialism and the open door policy. Remember, there was a debate that ensued after the acquisition of territories in the aftermath of the Spanish-American War between the pro-imperialist camp on the one hand and the anti-imperialist camp on the other hand. Now, I failed to mention a third camp emerged. This was the camp which was able to reconcile the debate, and they advocated for the open door of market expansion. In other words, economic empire, unburdened by the constraints of direct colonialism. This is something I mentioned to students as a virtual reality empire before the idea of virtual reality. Thus, Wilson took the United States to war to ensure the destruction of its major overseas economic rival, Germany, and to gain access to overseas markets. So let's discuss Wilsonian idealism for a moment. Wilson abandoned the traditional policy of non-intervention. Now, some historians will use the term isolation to describe this policy, but I find that term to be highly inaccurate. And I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but actually I think the term is idiotic, and it reminds me of neocons, both left-wing and right-wing, such as Hillary Clinton and John McCain. And before someone runs off and accuses me of being a Trump supporter or a communist or something crazy, and yes, both of those have happened, let me explain. Neocons here in the United States view everything through the lens of Munich and the idea that the British capitulated to Hitler when, according to the neocon worldview, the British and French should have gone to war. Thus, they refer to non-intervention or minding your own business derisively as isolationist. Who wants to be an isolationist? Anyway, Wilson wanted to, again, this is according to the traditional narrative, instill idealism into American foreign policy in order to inspire Americans to fight overseas. His two main goals were, quote, to make the world safe for democracy, unquote, and to fight a war to end war. Yeah, that makes sense. Let's go to war to end war. Okay, whatever. Of course, some historians, again, such as Williams and Rako, as well as Rothbard, would have argued that these high ideals were used to mask his true purpose, but that is the standard narrative. Thus, Wilson contrasted the seemingly selfish war aims of the Europeans with American altruism. I would say this is still part of the American playbook. Think about George W. Bush in his second inaugural speech. Now, I've mentioned that speech before, but this time I'm going to quote it. Quote, so it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture, with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world, end quote. Is this simply high rhetoric, or is this something else? It is Wilsonian, and certainly more than just high rhetoric, but I'll let you decide for yourself. Anyway, Wilson said the United States would not fight for profit or territorial conquest. Instead, he sought to shape an international order in which democracy could flourish without the fear of autocracy and militarism. Again, according to the standard narrative, he believed in the United States as a model for the world. In the end, he persuaded Americans, at least temporarily, to abandon their traditional aversion to overseas intervention and embark upon war. This brings us to Wilson's 14 points address to Congress in January 1918. The impact was that Wilson became the moral leader of the Allied cause. it ended up inspiring the embattled allies to push harder in the war. It demoralized the enemy governments by issuing promises to their dissatisfied minorities. And finally, it eventually convinced Germany to end the war, as she believed the Americans would treat her fairly in the post-war peace process. Instead of going through all 14 points, I'll give you the highlights. First, there was a provision to abolish secret treaties. Not very realistic, but okay. Secondly, it called for freedom of the seas. Third, the removal of economic barriers, also known as free trade. Fourth, for the reduction of armament burdens. Fifth, and this would be important in the eyes of at least one future revolutionary who came to be known as Ho Chi Minh, was a call for the adjustment of colonial claims in the interest of both native peoples and colonizers. Next was the promise of independence or self-determination to oppressed minority groups, millions of whom lived in Germany and Austria-Hungary. Now again, this was going to be important to someone like Ho Chi Minh, who heard it and thought the president was speaking to him and of the plight of his people. Finally, the 14th point called for the creation of an international organization to provide for collective security. This foreshadowed the creation of the League of Nations after World War I. Wilson hoped that it would guarantee political independence and territorial integrity of all countries, both large and small. All right, that's it for today. Now, I know this episode was a bit longer than normal. Next time, we'll continue our dive into World War I and look at the end of the war from more of a military history standpoint. However, do not fear, we will not be taking on battles minute by minute. Anyways, thanks for listening, and good day. Do you like the sound of the American History Podcast? My audio production is provided by the Mad Octopus. Check them out over at madoctopusmedia.com.